Thanks, Kevin O'Malley. Thanks for folks to be here. I appreciate it. This is our eighth year at SOCAP, Social Capital Markets. We're the market at the intersection of money and meaning. And we wanted to create this space between investing and giving that was as rigorous as investing, but that met the goals of philanthropy. When we started, that was a heresy. People said, you know, I invest for financial return. I give for good. Get out of the room if you say there's some space in between. We said there was a space in between. And it turns out we've created a marketplace. We'll have about 2,700 people from more than 70 countries this year. We're about 10 countries more than we were last year, and about 700 people more than we've had before. So it's where businesses that want to do good come to meet investors who want to invest in businesses that do good. But one of the things I realized, people were always wanting to say, bring SOCAP to our town, and they come from, you know, Cincinnati and Toledo and Little Rock and Istanbul and Sri Lanka and all over the world. And they said, bring SOCAP to us. And they said, well, we've tried to figure out what is it that they really want. What they want is an inclusive marketplace that where the valuable stranger is recognized and valued, and it's not the old boys club and sometimes the old girls club, but mostly the old boys club. And it's where those voices are valued. So we've realized that we wanted to look at that, and we wanted to figure out how to do that, how to bring that without going to 70 different places or 70 different countries or 100 different towns or something like that. And so we're working really hard in one town, one city, Cincinnati, that wanted to do that. We're doing a thing there called Neighborhood Economics, and we've hired our first employee to be a community quarterback. And our goal is to provide loans to African-American entrepreneurs who don't have collateral at a small microloans, and to figure out how to connect the community to that. So we're going to go further into that. But we went there because we realized that it's a lot easier, and you find a lot more impact investing going to Africans than you do to African-Americans. So we wanted to do something about that.
Okay, Johnny Price from Kiva.zip. I'm really glad that you're here tonight. Can you tell us, what's the difference between Kiva.org, and tell us a little bit about Kiva.org, and then tell us how Kiva.zip came out of that. Maybe tell us how you went from the commercial world into the nonprofit world.
Yeah, that's a great question. So my name's Johnny Price. I lead the Kiva.zip program at Kiva.org. As you can tell by my accent, I'm from the UK originally. I started my career in management consulting, but before I did that, in the UK, it's quite common to take a year out between high school and university and go and travel abroad and see the world, in quotes. And maybe you volunteer, maybe you travel, maybe you teach at a school. I did the latter. I taught at a school in Zambia for 8 months between high school and university. And that was a pretty transformative experience in my life. I came to see poverty and economic injustice very close up. And so then after college, I didn't really know how to get into that space. So as with a lot of undergraduates who don't really know what they want to do, I found my way into a career in management consulting. So I'm sorry about that. I did that for 6 years. Halfway through that, I came to volunteer at this nonprofit called Kiva, which is based here in San Francisco. At the time, they're in the Mission. Now we're in SoMa. And I found in Kiva this beautiful fusion of a very kind of mission-driven nonprofit that was intent on trying to alleviate poverty and tackle the gross economic injustice that exists in our world, but also a nonprofit that was using technology and was very metrics and data-driven in its approach. So just as Kevin was talking about SOCAP being this intersection between for-profit investing and philanthropy, so I think Kiva and many social enterprises, in quotes, are this new kind of hybrid of company that is extremely mission-driven, but also, you know, kind of has an economic focus and is looking at growth and customer acquisition and being very data-driven. So I volunteered at Kiva for a few months. Then I went back to consulting, but after drinking the Kiva Kool-Aid, I was quickly looking to get back into Kiva. And so 4 years ago, I was brought on to lead this Kiva.zip experiment, this Kiva.zip pilot. So that leads me to Kevin's question of what's the difference between Kiva and Kiva.zip? Well, many of you probably know, if you know Kiva, You'll know us as a nonprofit that makes microloans to poor people in the developing world. So you think of a Kiva borrower and you think of a farmer in Uganda. And the classic model is it's a crowdfunded microloan. So let's say we make a $500 loan to a farmer in Uganda. That $500 will come from 20 of us. 20 of us in this room might each lend $25. We aggregate it together. That's $500. And then we send that to the farmer in Uganda. Over time, as they repay that $500 microloan, which our historical repayment rate is 98%, so it's really high, you get your $25 back, and then you can re-lend that to help someone else. So it's kind of like giving, but it's the cheesy line is the gift that keeps on giving, because you get your $25 back and you can recycle it over and over again. So that's how the Kiva model works. There's two main differences between Kiva and Kiva Zip. The first is that Kiva is mostly international and it's mostly in the developing world. Kiva Zip is now exclusively focused in the US. So we are trying to reach African-American entrepreneurs in Ferguson, Missouri, or inner-city Detroit, or sustainable farmers in rural Arkansas, or ex-offenders in Dallas, or Native American entrepreneurs in New Mexico, or Vietnamese restaurant owners in the Tenderloin. We're here in San Francisco, or that taqueria in the Mission. So we're focused in the U.S. is one big difference. And the second, and this is a more kind of nuanced business model difference, but on Kiva, once we've crowdfunded that $500 microloan, we send it to an intermediary financial institution called a microfinance institution, an MFI, and the MFI sends the loan to the borrower. With the Kiva Zip model, we're cutting out the middleman, lending directly to the entrepreneur and accepting repayments directly from the entrepreneur. And I've spoken for way too long. There's a number of kind of exciting things that enables us to do, which hopefully I'll have time to get into.
Thanks very much, Johnny. Our next speaker tonight is Jenny Kasson. Jenny is a lawyer and has been involved in securities issues and at Cutting Edge Capital and now on her own, and also instrumental in helping create the Jobs Act. Can you tell us a little bit about your background with this and give us some information about what you've been working on that helps understand this conversation better?
Sure. So when I went to law school, I also, like Johnny, didn't really know what to do. So I said, oh, I'll go to law school. I'm sure I can use some of what I learned at law school to try to make the world a better place. And I learned quickly that a lot of the, you know, what we learned in law school about litigation was not really the way I wanted to go. I felt that there was a way that lawyers could contribute to making low-income communities healthier. So after law school, I went and worked in a low-income community in Oakland, and I became really passionate about the idea of keeping wealth local. And I'm sure a lot of you have heard over the last, you know, decade or so about the idea of shop local. Back 20 years ago when I graduated from law school, that was still a pretty new idea. But, you know, people really started to see that if we keep our dollars local, they will circulate in our communities, they will create more wealth, they will create more jobs. So that was something I was really passionate about, how to try to create healthier communities so that wealth could stay local. About 10 years after, you know, my beginning to work in this low-income community in Oakland, I decided it was time to move on, and I joined a law firm. I found a lawyer that was starting up a law firm, and this lawyer had a lot of expertise in the area of small business finance. And I realized that there was this whole area of law that I had known nothing about, even though I had gone to law school, passed the bar, been practicing law with this nonprofit community organization, and that is securities law. And securities law is something that was adopted at the beginning of the 1900s to try to protect investors from investing in things that might, you know, not be what it seems, that might be fraudulent, that might be too risky. And so I found out that because of these laws, it's somewhat challenging for regular folks to invest in their own communities. So there's something called an accredited investor, and this is created under law. And most people know nothing about this. I knew nothing about it, even as a lawyer. But an accredited investor is a wealthy investor with a certain minimum wealth or income. And if you're an accredited investor, the law assumes that you need less protection. So for enterprises that are raising money from accredited investors, there's pretty much a well-worn path for doing that. Any lawyer in downtown San Francisco or anywhere pretty much that you'd knock on their door and say, hey, I want to raise money, they're going to know how to raise money from those kinds of investors. So I just got really interested in, I wonder if there's a way that the you know other 97% of us can invest in our own community. So I started to really study securities law, and I found out that there actually are a lot of ways that it can be done. And I started working on making some of those, doing some of those things with clients, and also working on some changes to the law to add more options to that. So I've been working on that for the past 10 years or so. And what I'm really focusing on now is helping social entrepreneurs through that whole process of raising money in a way that's really in alignment with their goals and values, and helping them realize that there are many options. You don't have to go the way that we hear a lot about these days, which I call the Silicon Valley style of raising capital, which involves, you know, going after an angel and then a VC and then growing really fast and selling your company. There's many, many other ways to raise money.
Okay, well, Johnny, I want to ask you a question. So we're talking about social capital, and SOCAP, which is the name of the conference that this is a preview of, is about social capital. So there's a lot of definitions of that. Can you tell us, though, what that means to you and to Kiva in particular?
Yeah. I think the biggest vision that I have for what we're trying to do at Kiva is to reinsert human relationships into a financial system that has kind of drifted away from that. And so for me, there's many different ways in which we are trying to do that. One very obvious way is that if you get a loan from a regular lender, a bank, you're getting a loan from one financial institution whose aims are risk minimization and profit maximization. And on Kiva, you are getting a loan as an entrepreneur from a community of hundreds and hundreds of people whose aims might be a positive social impact in their community, or to give a chance to that immigrant entrepreneur that every bank in town is rejecting for a loan application. So the fact that the loan is coming from a community of people rather than one financial institution is one way in which we think our capital is social. Another way is that as a result of that, if you get a loan from a conventional lender, really you're getting money. That's what you're getting. With Kiva and other crowdfunding platforms as well, like Kickstarter and Indiegogo, we hope that we're providing a rich form of capital whereby we're connecting entrepreneurs with hundreds of people that can become their customers and that can give them business advice and that can become their brand ambassadors and promote their business on social media. And we did a survey recently, and over half of our borrowers that we've made loans to have told us they saw increased customers as a result of taking out a loan on Kiva Zip. And you hear this a lot with Kickstarter, that it's a proof point for demand for a product. And so another aspect of how we think our capital is social is that we're strengthening borrowers' social capital and their network and the connections to their hundreds of lenders, as well as just providing them with money. And then I think this is a more typical definition of social capital. It's capital that is seeking a social return as well as a financial return. So our lenders are not motivated, again, by financial return. They're motivated by helping out entrepreneurs in their community and giving a chance, expanding access to capital for entrepreneurs that might not otherwise be able to access them. And then the last one, and I'll talk about, is how we underwrite loans. So we talk about something we call social underwriting. And again, most conventional lenders, when they underwrite a loan, they'll look at financial data. So they'll look at your FICO score, they'll look at your cash flows, and they'll look at your collateral. Those are the three C's, credit score, cash flow, collateral, that for me exclude many small business entrepreneurs from typically accessing small business loans. Every day there are 8,000 small business loan applications rejected in this country. On the Kiva team, we're trying to underwrite a loan by looking at a borrower's character and standing in their community. And so the really innovative way that we do that, we have this concept called a private fundraising period, where once we've approved a loan, before we post it publicly on the site for you guys and the public to lend to on the public website, we say to the small business owner, you've got to go to your friends and family network and get a number of people, let's say it's 20 people, to lend to you in private. Send them this URL, this private URL. If they come to your loan and they lend you $25, once you've got 20 people, then we put you publicly on the site. And so that for us, we call it social underwriting. It's trying to get at, do you have that entrepreneurial spirit? Do you have that community that is willing to back you, even in only a small way, to the tune of $25? And that's the main way in which we underwrite our loans. So a number of different facets of social capital, the overarching umbrella of which is, you know, trying to reinsert human relationships into our financial system.
Kevin Jones, can you tell us a little bit more about the SOCAP conference and how it's grown and what it's going to mean this year and what you've chosen around neighborhoods this year?
Sure, thank you. We grew from about 600 in 2008, which was, debuted our conference 4 weeks after Lehman Brothers went under back in 2008, if you remember that kind of thing. And we were surprised we got 600 because at times it was almost kind of wanting to shut it down. I had to be told not to shut it down. And then we became a kind of a flight to hope that first year that there had to be some other system. And we've grown from 600 to 900 to 1100 to this year we'll be around 25 to 2700 if current trajectory looks like it will be. So about 5 to 600 more than we've ever been, about 10 countries more. But I think what we want to do is localize the impact because even if you look at pure venture-backed stuff, we do a lot of things that is around Series A and seed stage for venture things. But we realized a couple of years ago that a lot of the startups that are working on a couple sectors that are market rate, which means you can invest and get market rate, and it's a place where the market and justice overlap. And that's Obamacare meets mHealth for chronic diseases and financial inclusion, which is reducing the cost of being poor, not making money on being poor. The startups with great technology were failing because of a lack of cultural literacy, which means they were selling to people like themselves, empowered white straight folks, essentially. And they were selling into communities where there was collective decision making. You know, if you're trying to sell a healthcare app for type 2 diabetes to the first generation Filipino immigrants at 6th and Mission, you got to sell the Big Mama and you got to show up at Sunday lunch and you got to bring something that works with lumpia and then you've sold the block. And no one knew how to do that kind of collective sale, which is different than in Little Saigon, you're selling Hmong elders. And so there was a level of technology adoption not happening because, you know, folks thought that we were only selling individuals when we were selling into immigrant groups that were making decisions within a community. And so I started looking at that kind of thing. And I'm still working in those kinds of areas around financial inclusion a lot. But then I realized that, you know, in almost every other place in the country, venture doesn't really work. And so we're looking at where venture doesn't really work and how can we accelerate the flow of capital into poor and marginalized neighborhoods. So that's a lot of where our focus is because it's most of the world lives in places that aren't Silicon Valley or Boston or New York.
Great. Well, here's a question for all three of you, and you can answer it and you can debate it if you like. This is a panel tonight where I think most of you are going to agree with each other, but it's not too much controversy up here. But I'm interested in largely what are the pros and cons of crowdfunding for this kind of deal. But I'm also especially interested in direct public offerings and what that means, and maybe you can start.
Sure. So I'm a huge fan of crowdfunding. It just opening up the opportunity to invest in an impact investment, a social enterprise, to more people, to me, is incredibly exciting for so many reasons. One, of course, it gives, like I was saying before, unaccredited investors don't have many options for investing things that may be in their own community, like a restaurant that they really want to support or a business that they know is creating jobs for people in their own community. So just crowdfunding allows regular folks to invest. And then, of course, from the entrepreneur's perspective, it's amazing how much easier it is to raise money when you're raising money from 100% instead of 3%. And, you know, especially when, you know, the minimum investment is $25, $500, $1,000, whatever. It just, I've had many, many clients that tried to raise money in more traditional ways and failed, and then went out to the public offering an investment opportunity and reached their goal. And just to clarify with terminology, there is this thing called a direct public offering, and that's just one name for an offering of an investment opportunity that is open to the general public and can be publicly advertised. So there's many, many different things that could fall into that category. There's many different legal compliance strategies that allow you to do that. I think it's really synonymous with the term investment crowdfunding. So, you know, whatever you call it, the idea is that you can open up the investment opportunity to everybody, and you can publicly advertise the opportunity.
So, for me, crowdfunding fits into this zeitgeist that we're in around a collaborative sharing economy, right? So, crowdfunding is to finance as Wikipedia is to encyclopedias, or Airbnb is to hotels, or Lyft and Uber are to taxis, right? It's the same principle of kind of decentralizing the bank or decentralizing the hotel. So on Kiva, rather than the bank's centralized underwriting formula determining which small business owner gets a loan, it's you and me that determines which small business owner gets a loan. And I think that's really cool, and it's in alignment with this kind of shift to this collaborative sharing economy. And I think there are some very clear positives for that. We can make loans to a lot of entrepreneurs in America and in Africa that financial institutions, based on those kind of averages and algorithms, which do not account for the character of an entrepreneur, really, fail to do. So we can radically expand access to capital. And we can strengthen that social capital that I mentioned earlier by connecting entrepreneurs and borrowers with hundreds of lenders that are going to give them business advice and become customers of their business. So that's the pros. The main con for me, I think, would be around consistency. So if you stay at Hilton Hotel, or I was a management consultant, so we were addicts to SPG points, so we would always stay at Starwood hotels. So you knew exactly what you were going to get, right? And you knew at a Sheraton what you were going to get, and you knew at a Four Seasons what you were going to get. And at Airbnb, sometimes it can be a lottery, and you can have a great experience at an Airbnb, or you can have a less good experience. And I hope that, I mean, Lyft is a great example. I tend to have better experiences in Lyft than I do in taxis. And I think that's because there's an accountability there. And over time, you can give ratings to Lyft drivers. And so the bad drivers kind of drop off the system. But I just looked up Kevin Jones on Wikipedia. And there's Kevin Jones, BMX rider. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's this guy. Mm-hmm. There's Kevin Jones, rugby league. Mm-hmm. I doubt that Kevin Jones on my left can articulate the differences between rugby league and rugby union. So that's not him either. It's Kevin Jones, American football. Kevin right. Jones, cricketer, basketball, a politician. I don't think any of those are the Kevin Jones on my left, right? But I could go home tonight and write a Wikipedia article about Johnny Price. And so then there's no Wikipedia article. And I want to create one for you, by the way. But there's no Wikipedia article about the founder of SoCap, but I could create one about this kid that went to Africa, right? So I think there's a lack of consistency, which could be, and in the financial space, that could give rise to bad investments. And people, it's probably easier for a borrower to defraud Kiva, or, you know, for fraud to happen in crowdfunding. And so I think there's a lot of work right now that's going into regulation. The Jobs Act is a part of that. The Treasury has a request for information out right now about online marketplace lending, which I'm really excited about. So I think consistency is one thing for me, but there are definite pros and cons of crowdfunding.
you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's interesting. There used to be a snowboarder who would come up first, but I guess he's not there anymore. That's why I use my middle name, Kevin Doyle Jones, because you know I'm not going to reach the mass market thing. So I believe in crowdfunding. I think it's the way in. In fact, in Cincinnati, we've hired a fellow, an African-American guy from Cincinnati. We're calling the community quarterback who will connect all the dots. But he's going to come and be a Kiva fellow. He's going to be training under Johnny in January. And one of the great things that crowdfunding does is it gets a lot of people involved. And we're focusing on, as I mentioned, you know, African-American entrepreneurs, because it's kind of a black, white, post-industrial town. The virtue of Cincinnati is that they had some race riots in 2002, and then they started talking to each other. And so black folks and white folks and poor folks and rich folks talk to each other in ways that they don't in other towns. And so we're going to be using an economic means to create some of the bridges between affluent and other neighborhoods. And then banks get involved. There's this law called the Community Reinvestment Act, which means banks are supposed to invest in neighborhoods they don't want to go to. And they don't do much with it, but they do enough to get by. In several cities, in Louisville, they've invested $250,000 to double down on Kiva Zip loans. So that means that every $5,000 loan becomes a $10,000 loan. And so they are both getting a higher impact on their CRA, Community Reinvestment Act dollars, but they're also reaching the Rotarians and the church folks that they want to reach, the Junior League, who become the loan teams. And so they love that part about it. And so I think it's a way to get money to poor folks, easy.
Well, all three of you, can you answer the question now? So let's say that I don't want to just do a Kiva loan. Let's say that I want to take my money that I would be investing in my retirement account, and I want to invest in a triple bottom line and do the traditional SOCAP kind of thing where I get put my money where my meaning is, which is the tagline from the past for SOCAP. So now, if I don't want to just do crowdfunding, I don't want to just put in $25 to go to someone out of the country, but I want to put in my retirement money and get a decent return. What are the devices I can use, the financial devices or tools I can use to do that now? And how does that work for me?
Yeah, so, and just another clarification on a legal point. Because if you invest in Kiva, you're not receiving any financial return. You're only getting your principal back. It is able to avoid a lot of the regulatory hoops that an investment offering has to go through. So let's say you decide, you know what, Kiva's great, but I want to make some kind of a return on my investment. And I'm not accredited, and I don't even have any extra money lying around. All I have is my retirement account. What can I do? So there actually are some things available right now. I will admit it's not a lot yet, but it is growing. So one thing to be aware of, first of all, is that with your retirement account, there's something called a self-directed IRA. And so what you have the right as someone who holds retirement funds to put some or all of those funds into a custodial account, and then you can choose to invest it in whatever you want. And you just direct the custodian to put it into whatever you want. So once you do that, then you're ready to go ahead and invest some portion of your retirement funds into a direct public offering. And there are quite a few out there. It does tend to be somewhat state specific whether you can invest. So, for example, I happen to have worked with a lot of enterprises in California and Massachusetts that have done direct public offerings. If you're in Texas, for example, you may not be able to find one. But one example that is actually available nationwide is there's a nonprofit called RSF Social Finance. And it's a nonprofit lender that invests in social enterprises. And they offer the opportunity for anyone to invest in them in the form of making them a loan. And the minimum investment is $1,000. And you do receive a return on that. And they've gone through the legal hoops that makes it possible for them to offer that. I believe it's now available in all 50 states. And then I have other clients that are maybe just doing it in California, just Colorado. I have a really interesting client in Colorado that makes outdoor gear, and they're offering stock to Colorado residents only because they've just gone through the compliance process to offer their stock to Colorado. So we have to keep our eyes out for those opportunities, but I'm seeing it grow for sure. There's more and more available.
Great. So, Kevin Jones, you've been talking about platform interoperability.
Sure.
Platform interoperability.
Right.
Can you explain what you mean by platforms and what that interoperability
means? Sure. Well, Facebook is a platform. Google is a platform. In this social impact space, there are platforms that have arisen in the last couple of years. One is the Resilience Exchange. It's kind of like GitHub for climate change. You know, where you put up a solution and people can share it and break it apart. Do that kind of thing. We are coming out with what we're calling the SOCAP API at SOCAP, and it's a data exchange because as investors look at all these things, there's lots of siloed platforms. Okay, there are digital platforms for collective due diligence. One arose out of India called Rianta. Now it's being used in Central and South America by the Inter-American Development Bank. And so it's ways where investors can gather to figure out if they want to invest in a deal. They're the ones who are leading this thing, and it's a data protocol. Getting real geeky, but it really does matter, so that we can decide what an enterprise name is, and we can swap the data. So we're working with an index in the UK that has 1,000 different what they call social businesses, with Rianta, with our 150 SOCAP scholarship entrepreneurs. With Impact IQ, which has a database of 5,000 or so enterprises, and we're all agreeing on what the base unit is. So it means that data can be exchanged so that investors can make better decisions. So that's platform interoperability. Historical analogy is that this is about like it was when railroads arose in the early 19th century, and they didn't agree on the gauges. And so the Erie Railroad would have to stop and offload the freight to get to the Illinois Central because they couldn't agree on the gauges of the railroads. These platform interoperability means you don't have to offload all the freight, take it off, put it over there. You can swap the data, and so commerce can flow. So it's an emergent layer of that shows the market is evolving so that we can agree on what it is we're talking about. When I say an enterprise, a social enterprise, this is what I mean, and so we're jumping ahead, we're getting more and more groups involved in doing it, but it means that we can it's like a crucial piece of translation. It's kind of like currencies between countries are starting to be exchanged. That's maybe another analogy. So it means we're doing stuff where we can make sense of the world.
And just to give a specific example, I don't know if this is exactly in line with what you're thinking about here, but we're starting to develop partnerships now with Kiva Zip, where we're partnering with lenders that do much larger loans. So our larger loans to date have been $10,000, which is pretty small. Like if you're starting a small business in San Francisco, if you're opening a restaurant in San Francisco, you need a lot more than $10,000. So we see ourselves as the first rung on the ladder of credit, right, for people that can't access loans from a bank or a lending club or a Prosper. But then our goal is that we're the first rung, and we're graduating our borrowers to larger sources of capital in the future. So you pay back a $5,000 to $10,000 Kiva Zip loan, and then if we can help boost your credit score, or if we can give you a nice kind of handoff to a lending club that can then make you a $25,000 loan, or an opportunity fund that can make you a $50,000 loan, then I think that's one good example of potentially of this kind of platform.
It's exactly like that, yeah. One of the other platforms that we're looking at is a really interesting quality of life indicator that came out of Brazil, out of the Amazon into the city, and now it's being used in Detroit. And Ernst & Young is getting around it. All the city and state is getting around it. So it means, like, what are you really doing? What's happening as a result of this? Can you show that people's lives are better? Well, they've got a lot of really smart people. Pacific Community Ventures, who's based here, is one of the folks involved. They're figuring out. So we can tell them the fly that, you know, we meant to do good and we did, or we meant to do good and we didn't do as good. But that's a really valuable thing that's needed. So we're going to plug that in to the platforms that are interoperating. We're building an operating system in one way.
What's the name of that platform?
In Detroit, it's called PIP, Passion in Philanthropy. But they've modified it for Detroit because Detroit and Brazil are not the same. But they use the same sorts of metrics.
Here's another question for all three of you. What are the role of large institutional investors in what we're talking about today, in investing in neighborhoods. Is there still a divide between family funds or the larger funds that have now become increasingly a big part of SOCAP? And where do the family foundations come in and give money? Do the family foundations help support the infrastructure? So how does the whole ecosystem work?
This is just one part of the answer to that question, but one thing I really like to remind everyone with crowdfunding, direct public offerings, investment crowdfunding, it's open to the 100%. So we have seen a lot of cases where some people come in at $100, $1,000, and then larger investors, family offices, foundations, etc., will come in at $50,000, $100,000, etc. So what I love about crowdfunding is that it's open to everybody, and that's where, you know, it's truly democratized. Everyone can participate.
And do you find that large funders will come in and they won't say, oh, it's just an Indiegogo thing? Are you seeing larger investments?
We have seen it. I don't think it's extremely common yet, but we've definitely seen it.
Donnie.
Yeah, we've had a bunch of family foundations come and do what Kevin referenced earlier with the CRA. Banks have given us money to match loans. Family foundations have done it as well. So the Dilla von Furstenberg Family Foundation, Diane von Furstenberg's foundation, has given us $500,000 and then another $500,000 to do loan matching in the U.S. The Knight Foundation gave us loans when we launched with President Clinton in Detroit, the Rita Allen Foundation in Newark, New Jersey. And so how that works, this idea of loan matching, is that the Knight Foundation says, if you as a lender on Kiva, if any of us in this room went to the Kiva Zip website tonight and made a loan to an entrepreneur in Detroit for $25, the Knight Foundation would match that. And then over time, as you get your $25 back as the borrower repays their loan, the Knight Foundation gets their $25 back, and then they can either withdraw that. And so if they invest $500,000, then after one cycle with a 90% repayment rate, they lose $50,000, but they take $450,000 back. Or they can just, what most people do, is keep it recycling over and over again. So we've had a number of foundations use their money to match lending from the crowd. And you'd expect that to double the rate of fundraising, right, for these loans. Actually, we found it increases the rate by 4x, because if you as a lender, you see the x2 icon on a loan, these loans are being matched by the Knight Foundation, which is great positive brand impressions and brand awareness for the Knight Foundation, by the way. But you're twice as likely to click on that loan with the x2 icon. So then we see that these entrepreneurs fundraise four times as quickly. So it's a great way that these family foundations can use their funding and their capital to catalyze investment from people in their community and these entrepreneurs.
Okay, well, I'd like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is SOCAP Preview 2015, Funding What Matters in Our Local Economies. I'm Kevin O'Malley, Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. Our panelists tonight, Jenny Kasson, Kevin Jones, and Johnny, whose name is just slipped.
Johnny Price.
Johnny. So I would like to now we'll be turning it over to the audience for questions in just a minute. Johnny Price, I'm very sorry. So
it's fine. There'll be a Wikipedia page on me later tonight.
later.
If I had pulled out my cell phone, I could have checked.
Yeah, that's right.
But I have a question for you all now. If you are an independent consultant working on this, or you're an institutional structure, a platform, or if you're putting on a conference, how do you judge your own way to make a living doing this? I'm sure this is kind of a tricky question, but how does one evaluate one's own worth? How does one evaluate what the market will bear, what's fair? Is there a golden rule that's been established for this, or is it still the Wild West? I'll start with Johnny. Johnny Price.
So that's a great question. When I left management consulting, I took a big pay cut to go and work at Kiva. And there's not been a single day when I've regretted that decision. So for me, I run into work every day. I'm extremely energized and passionate about what I'm doing. And so I think what all of us on this panel are saying is that, you know, like why Kevin founded SOCAP is that it's not just about money. And that's very true in my life, but hey, it means a pay cut and I'm cool with that.
Well, this is my 14th year doing this, and this is the first year I'm getting a salary from. I've made money in other businesses, and the businesses I've started, the Impact Hubs here in Berkeley and D.C. and New York, as well as in San Francisco, are making money as well as the hubs, and so I don't need to fund growth. I'm actually drawing a paycheck, so that's, you know, it's a nice thing.
People raise money for their businesses, it's not unreasonable to ask that they pay for those services. So, plus, you know, being a lawyer, being able to help people do all their legal documents to make sure they're doing it right, I am able to charge for my services. I'm not making what I would be making if I were a seventh year associate or partner at a large corporate law firm, but I love my work.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Kevin and all of you, I think that is one of the big issues that we all face when we're involved in doing work for good. So sometimes there's a mental thing that we're not supposed to be paid as much as in the corporate world. And so how do you address the psychology of that? How do you address the thing of equal and fair pay for people who are doing this kind of work? Kevin, maybe you can tell us, how does SOCAP as a movement address these issues?
Well, we as a movement are still new, still really struggling. And SOCAP is doing better than it's ever done, but it's a typical event packages up buyers to reach sellers. And we don't. We're building the field. And a lot of our grants in previous years have come from foundations who want to build the field. So that means people who are working in this field are underpaid. They're underpaid and they're overworked. They're paid a little bit better than in the nonprofit sector, but not much. It's not as good as it should be, but it's all that the market will bear at this moment. So it's still in its kind of painful growing phases. You know, I've been at it 14 years and I'm finally drawing a paycheck. That's maybe typical of something.
At the same time, I think some of the people that you might be comparing us to are making way more than they should be making. Some of the CEOs of multinational corporations, lawyers at big corporate law firms. So, I think it needs to go in both directions.
Sure.
Okay, do we have any audience questions? Elizabeth, if you could start.
A question for Kevin. My name's Cameron Cross. I'm over here from Australia. I'm actually going to SOCAP, so I look forward to seeing it all. I have a question around where you were talking about the interoperability between platforms and developing a common set of language, frameworks, ways of relating with each other. I'm assuming you're talking about how to measure impact and ways of measuring investment opportunities.
No. Metrics is a chump game put up by Victorians that want to fund the working, fund the deserving poor. We really want to share the data that investors want to know. So how should I invest in this space? So how can we know what an enterprise is that we're describing together? So that I can send you a profile, you can send me a profile, you might invest in it. I want to invest in it. I think metrics is metrics is a power game by Victorian thinking philanthropists.
So I would agree with that fully. I think the definitions around what people are using to measure impact is it's some university courses where they're dissecting things to the nth degree. So are you talking about developing a common international language around how to define?
Well, we've got a definition. Then we've got seven groups, and it looks like USAID wants to join us as well with their innovation exchange of the base unit. An analogy, a friend of mine worked for news.com, CNET, and they had grown by acquisition. They had 12 different advertising commission structures within it. So they couldn't figure out if they're making money or not. They'd bought ZDNet, they'd bought all these things. They figured out what the base unit was, what an advertising unit was that they could sell around, and then they could integrate all the platforms that they had integrated. So that we're at the sales level of saying this is the base unit. We can swap data here, and we can grow everything from there. But you have to start by sharing data and agreeing on a single, simple standard.
So you're identifying patterns.
Yeah, the definition of what an enterprise is, so that we can do due diligence for an investment on the Rienta platform from the SOCAP entrepreneurs, from the Impact IQ platform, from the SVX platform in Canada, and from the Social Business Index in the UK. So we can we couldn't swap data before. Everybody had their own way they defined it. We said, let's just, you know, we'll do a manifesto if people are happy, but let's swap data and agree on that. And then we've actually come up with a pretty good manifesto. But manifestos are an aftermarket product.
I would very much appreciate being able to have a conversation with you.
Okay, great.
Can I ask you to dig in on what you meant by the metrics comment and the Victorians?
You know, sure. I think metrics is just, you know, it's a leftover of Victorians trying to fund the deserving poor, and it's a system that's gamed, and I think there are unacknowledged power issues all over it. And
but
no,
what do you mean by metrics?
So, yeah, exactly. It is a game of there's a theory of change of an investor or a funder, and they make the enterprise, nonprofit or for-profit, match those metrics, but they don't give them any money to handle the cost of that metric, and the metrics don't help the entrepreneur achieve their goals. I think
what's one example of a metric?
Well, you know, simple things is, you know, how many lives saved, how many people's housed, but then they make you quantify lots of things that they need that you don't need. So it's a distraction from actually getting the job done. A really great metric that I know, and this is a related field, a fellow I know ran a homeless shelter in New York, and a big funder wanted to give him a whole bunch of money, but they had to figure out what the root cause of homelessness was. And he says, like, look, we feed people and we do needle exchange, and our best metric is actually how many people who will do needle exchange will let us wash the sores off of their bodies. But that's not a metric because they wanted the root cause. He said, we're a frontline homeless shelter, and we're on a bad street. We're on a needle exchange type street with people with sores. And the metric should be how many of those people can deal with their schizophrenia and other things that let us wash their sores so they'll be healthier. And so they had to take like almost 1.5 staffers of actually working with people to support the donors' metrics.
But so you're not opposed to metrics per se. Like, no. If we find the right metrics, then absolutely they can be very powerful and help us invest in the right areas. You're just saying like the ways that many funders, philanthropists in the past have kind of imposed onerous burdens on.
I want a caduceus on every metric. You know, the first thing about your metrics, if you're going to oppose it, make sure it does no harm. Does no harm to the mission, does no distraction, and it actually helps the entrepreneur do their job.
Well, I love that. I think I have a slightly controversial perspective on this, and it's in line with you. And there's 5 people on our team, and we're charged with making – we want to make 2,000 loans next year for $10 or $15 million, and we're really busy. You know, and so the idea of taking 20% of those resources, one of our staff, which is, by the way, because business as usual takes up a lot of our 5 people, so that's like a huge proportion of the slack that we have to invest in infrastructurally improving the program. The idea of taking a huge proportion of that and sacrificing growth, like rather than investing those resources in growing this extremely fragile nascent program or like improving our repayment rate, and taking those resources and trying to sift through sand of like 2,000 data points where there's no way we can kind of robustly say we're having this impact on jobs created or, you know, business increase in business revenue, is I don't want to do that. So I agree. Thank you.
Yeah. I think funders need to check their privilege at the door before they impose a metric on an entrepreneur.
Great. Let's go to an audience question now.
Is there any new company that you're very excited about to see in the future, or like any company that doesn't exist yet that you would like to see in the future that's, you know, working on something similar?
I think that's a question for all 3.
So I'm really excited. Jenny can speak much more than I can to this point, but the passage of the Jobs Act through Congress a few years ago and now the implementation of that, I think is going to lead to a huge and really exciting new wave of equity-based crowdfunding platforms. So I think that that wave is still depending on looking at how the regulations are going to be implemented. But once that's been settled, I think this is going to be a really, really exciting new space that's going to see a lot of very exciting companies grow very quickly over the next few years.
Great. Yeah, let's see, any company you're really excited about, or any field, or...
Yeah, there's a company I'm really excited about. It's a video game company, and it's an Alaskan tribal group, the Cook Inlet Group, bought a video game company in New York, and they're using it to tell the stories of the tribe to folks who are on their phones, you know, folks like kids, you know, and so it's a story of a young girl. But it's an old story, and she had to win by collaboration. But it's getting the stories, because how they do their intergenerational learning is by story. So that video game is really interesting, and there's a lot of other tribes lining up to do that. So I think, I think preserving the culture of indigenous people is essential for climate change, because they know how to adapt to the land in ways that we don't. And so their cultural transmission is really important. So that video game company, it's really led by just a really smart tribe. Cook Inlet is a really smart tribal group, and they're reaching folks in ways that it's causing a big impact. I can go on further about it, but I think it's a really good thing. Cook Inlet, Cook Inlet is the tribal group. I forget the name of the game. What's that? Never great. Never alone. Yeah.
Elon Ventures. Okay, so it's
Cook Inlet. Yeah, that's right.
Cook Inlet, Never Alone.
And Elon Ventures is they took majority ownership of this video game company, and you know the tribal group is in charge of finances for them. So yeah.
Jeannie, one more. What's a hot company that you are excited about, or an area, something that you think is really gonna take off?
Yeah, well, just to follow up with what Johnny said, I think it is exciting to see what will happen. I don't know how many people have heard of the Crowdfund Act, which was part of the Jobs Act, which was passed in 2012. It still hasn't gone into effect, and people were very excited about it. Now, currently, that doesn't mean we can't do investment crowdfunding. As I've mentioned, it's very possible to do. It's happening right now. But what is a lot more difficult to do is to have a third-party platform, to use that word again, intermediary to offer those investment opportunities. So that piece of the Jobs Act that hasn't gone into effect yet will make it easier to create those third-party platforms. So we might really see an explosion of the ability of regular folks to invest in, you know, things in their own community, make smaller investments, diversify their portfolio by making small investments in lots of different social enterprises.
Great, let's have another question from the audience.
Hello, I wanted to follow up on the question on the retirement accounts and the 2% versus 100%. We're up against an incumbent system where they say they privatize the profits and socialize the loss enterprises. Now, if I look at the social enterprises, we are mostly busy with looking how can we promise a market rate return to the impact investors who can write large checks, and then we ask the crowds to invest for donations or 0%. So my question is there, if you look a little bit, probably Jenny could comment a bit on that, if we look a little bit forward, is there any chance that we overcome the investment divide when it comes to returns?
That's such a great question, and I think the first thing we need to do is not use the term market rate returns without really being clear about what we mean by that. I think when you ask a VC, a venture capitalist, what they consider a market rate return, they'll say, oh, well, a market rate return is I want 5 to 30 times my original investment in the next 5 years. That's what they consider a market rate return. However, if you look at what the Kauffman Foundation found when they analyzed the actual performance of VC funds, they're basically not even making, it's below zero. So don't believe it when you say that, when you hear someone say that's a market rate return. Also, if you look at what people make when they invest in the stock market over time, yes, we have periods where people do quite well. We also have periods where people do quite poorly. Over time, I've heard the estimate that it's about 3% per year. If you put your money in a CD at a bank, it's less than 1%. So I think that's a really important thing that we need to talk about, is what really is a market rate return. And if you're investing in, let's say, one of my favorite companies is Equal Exchange, which is a coffee and chocolate company. It's a worker co-op. They've raised millions of dollars from investors, and what they offer is a 5% annual return. And, you know, they have to turn investors away. A VC might laugh at a 5% annual return, but guess what? They've actually done better than the stock market over time. So, and they have enough money left over that they're able to pay their workers really well. They're able to make sure that all of their suppliers are fair trade suppliers, co-ops that are treating the coffee growers really well. They're doing really well by the planet. So I think it's very possible to pay, quote, market rate returns and still treat all the other stakeholders really, really well.
We have new research at SOCAP that we've got funding for this year on divest, invest, divest from carbon fuel. And we've got 12 different categories of and places you can put your money where you will outperform and you will not have the carbon-fueled economy. So that's our first move into public equities and that kind of thing. And I think it's got a lot of interesting potential.
I think about these things as a spectrum. On one end of the spectrum, you've got pure philanthropy, right, where you lose 100%, like as an investment, you lose 100% of your money. Actually, you get a tax write-off, and so let's say you lose 60 or 70% of your money. And then on the other hand, you've got investing in for profit, whether that's in the stock market, which is kind of a form of crowdfunding, or in lending club, where I invest in lending club will prosper and I get a 5 or 6% rate of return from those investments. And there's no hint of kind of social impact. I'm not doing that for social impact. I'm doing that to make money. My Wells Fargo checking account, I think, pays me about 0.25% interest. So that's like somewhere in the middle. On Kiva, historically, we've had a 2% default rate on $750 million of loans. But then our lenders are very generous. And so on average, they tip us, they donate 5%. So if you make a $25 loan, on average, people donate $125, 5% to cover my salary, which is very nice of them. Thank you. But that's like a, you know, 5% donation plus a 2% default is a 7% loss. So it's between the 60, 70% philanthropy loss and the 0.25% Wells Fargo, right? And then it's a great question. I think there's a market opportunity. And like when you asked a question earlier, Kevin, Jenny mentioned RSF Social Finance, who I love. But there's no kind of crowdfunding platform for social-based investment, right? And so, and partly that's because the Jobs Act hasn't yet been implemented. And when it is, we're going to see a lot of kind of for-profit-based crowdfunding, equity-based crowdfunding platforms spin up, like the Lending Club for Equity, where it's just going to be about investing for profit. And I think there's a huge market opportunity for, you know, a socially minded equity-based crowdfunding platform where lenders are getting a rate of return, which they're not on Kiva, but the investments are in B Corps or in businesses with a triple bottom line. Oh, no, you should build that platform.
Okay, let's have another audience question.
She's back there?
Maybe up in front, and then after that, the lady in the back. Right here in the front. And then the lady in the back.
We've talked a little bit about market rate of return and the contrast, but obviously if we could unleash the flood of private investment, which was specifically looking for market rate of return, we would much more, I don't even know what the number is, multiply the amount of money available to socially responsible. You talk, Johnny, a lot about the sort of social underwriting process and the social values. And I think that's really what's at the bottom of sort of the metric equivalency work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because, in fact, if we can get this somehow means of exchange, can you talk a little bit more about how do you talk about the metrics of social profit or social good? How do you measure the good? Because if I'm happy with a zero or even a tiny percent, it's because I'm happy about the social good. Is that just because I feel warm because I've given money, or is there something I can point to? How do we talk about that to unleash this flood of billions of dollars?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have a very good answer. Part of it for me, I think about the starting point. So I'm extremely proud of the fact that 2/3 of our loans are to ethnic minorities, 45% of our loans are to businesses in their first year of operation, who typically are highly financially excluded from access to conventional capital because they don't have years of cash flow that they can demonstrate. So part of it is we can think about the entrepreneurs that we're reaching, and then I think part of it is the outcome metrics over time, which Kevin is maybe skeptical of, around job creation. And I think it's very difficult to say, you know, the loans that we made resulted in these jobs versus they would have happened anyway. So I don't have a very good answer on that question, I'm afraid. I would say that I think what crowdfunding enables us to do is for individual investors, if you want to call them that, or lenders on Kiva, or people, everyone in this room gets to make that their own personal trade-offs. And so I might be extremely passionate about the cause of small-scale, sustainable agriculture in this country. So I can decide to lend to some of the farmers we have on Kiva Zip. I watched the film Selma the other day and was very inspired about racial justice in this country. And so then I might go and lend to this, you know, African-American entrepreneur in inner city Detroit. But I think what this crowdfunding model allows us to do is to empower everyone to make their own very nuanced, very specific personal trade-offs, because everyone has a different perspective on what impact means.
And I'm not skeptical of metrics. I'm skeptical of the power relationships by funders, either donors or investors around metrics. I can go into the really articulate metrics that our portfolio companies at Good Capital have, and you know we've done a lot of things. But I don't think metrics are motivators. There's a common thought that, geez, if I could just show it and quantify it for people, people would do stuff. Yeah. Metrics don't motivate. Metrics quantify, but stories motivate. I don't think that, you know, when you stamp, you know, a waffle grid spreadsheet on a heart, the heart is not more valuable. You know, you are actually detracting value when we measure many things. You know, the Nokia phone was quantifiably better than the iPhone, but the iPhone was emotionally better than the iPhone, and the Nokia phone doesn't really exist. Commodities are comparisons of features. So I think we've, in the impact space, probably bought into too much of an old dream of Wall Street that you want to quantify things. In a way that reduces them to commodities. I think, you know, we should, this giving and impact investing is a luxury good. We should sell it much more like Godiva chocolate than we do a spreadsheet.
That sounds good. Unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program where we only have time for one more question, and then we will come back to each of our panelists maybe to give us a Twitter-like 140-character closing comment. I would like to let our audience listening at home know this is the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley, Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the Club. Our program tonight has been SoCap Preview 2015, Funding What Matters in Our Local Economies, with Kevin Jones, Jenny Kasson, and the famous Johnny Price. So with that, I would like to turn it over to a question.
Jenny, I'm wondering how some of these crowdfunding techniques do or could apply to real estate investing. I'm particularly thinking about here in the local level in San Francisco and in the Bay Area, we're both in the midst of a housing crisis, but also a development boom. And I'm a city planner. I talk to lots of community members throughout the state that are concerned about gentrification, about getting priced out of their communities. And if there's a way for them to participate in the upside of the development of their neighborhood, and also in that way becoming, for low-income people, not just being a recipient of loans, but becoming a participant and an investor in their communities.
Yes, absolutely. After law school, I got a master's in city planning to delay figuring out what I was going to do. So this is something that I thought a lot about. I think it is so needed right now. I've actually talked to quite a few people in the affordable housing community about the idea of creating a community investment fund to support affordable housing. So yes, this is definitely possible.
There's a company called Fundrise that does crowdfunding for real estate. I don't know if you know those guys, but I don't know, actually.
I want to just mention something. There's a lot of confusion in this world of crowdfunding, so I just want to mention one thing, and that is sometimes you'll hear about, oh, we already have a lot of equity crowdfunding platforms. There's like 100 of them, and You know, there's one called Circle Up, there's one called Angel List. Now, I personally don't consider that investment crowdfunding because those platforms are only open to accredited investors, meaning wealthy investors. And my understanding is that Fundrise did some campaigns that were open to everyone, but now all the Fundrise campaigns are only open to accredited investors. And this is because of the legal issues. It's much easier to create a platform for investment crowdfunding if it's only open to accredited investors. So, yes, those are great, but you know, we're excited about the day when everyone can invest in on those platforms.
Okay, thank you. Well, we are out of time now. I'd like to ask each of our panelists to give us a short closing and maybe inspire us in how to move forward in our own lives and how to do this thing. Jenny, why don't we start with you?
I think the most important thing is just realize there are so many ways of doing things. Don't listen to the first lawyer you talk to that tells you, oh, it must be done like this. Look around, explore, and think outside the box. We're living in a time where we need that kind of thinking. So find the lawyers and the supporters that will help you do that.
Johnny?
So I was at a Slow Money conference in Louisville last year, and a kid, he must have been about 10 or 11 years old, asked the question, how can we help a farmer? And it was just a beautiful question, and I wrote a blog post about it. My blog post said, well, you can make a $25 loan to them on KivaZip. And that's a self-serving answer. But the beautiful thing about crowdfunding is that it empowers us in a very, very small way to get involved in the solution to the problem, right? So whether it's lending to an entrepreneur, a financially unserved entrepreneur on KivaZip, or whether it's if education is your thing, go on Donors Choose, find an awesome school in a high poverty area, and donate $20 to this teacher's project. If homelessness is your thing, there's this awesome company called Hand Up that crowdfunds support for homeless people in San Francisco. But crowdfunding is about individual people stepping up and in a very, very small and personal way being part of the solution. So go home tonight and be part of that solution.
Thank you, Kevin Jones.
Yeah, I think if there's one thing I'm about, it's about subverting the dominant myth of capital. And that myth is that you invest for financial return in yourself and then you give for good. I think you can invest for all of us and invest for yourself, get the money back and do it again.
All right, thank you very much. So I would like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club, our audience listening at home. Our program tonight has been SoCap Preview 2015, Funding What Matters in Our Local Economies. Our panelists were Kevin Jones, Jenny Casson, and Johnny Price. I'm Kevin O'Malley, and with this, I would like to close our program tonight at the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion. This program's adjourned.